Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and to God's glory and that of his kingdom. To do that, I'm very pleased to be able to start by saying welcome once again to one of our regulars, the great Charles Sam Faddis. Sam is, of course, no stranger to this audience, but he is one of those American patriots who has served with great distinction in a whole variety of capacities in the United States Army, as an assistant attorney general out in Washington State, as a undercover operative of the Central Intelligence Agency, and now as the publisher and driving force behind a terrific online resource and magazine.com. Sam, it's so good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Great to be here as always, Frank. Thank you very much.
You have been following closely a developing story and helping the rest of us, I think, make sense of both what's going on and what are the implications in a way that I think is most important and helpful. It involves the President of the United States and his family. It involves a degree of corruption that I'm not sure we've ever seen in that office, and that's saying something to this point. Give us a sense of what we know about Joe Biden's personal and familial corruption, Sam Faddis, and by whom?
Well, let me grab a hold of this, pulling on the thread of Hunter Biden's laptop, right? Which by this point, I presume, unless you're in a coma somewhere out there in the United States, you've at least heard of this.
You've heard it was Russian disinformation until very recently. The New York Times actually copped to the fact that it wasn't. But yes, I think most of us have heard something about it. But tell us what it bears on this particular question.
We went through the phase where you were told that there was a laptop, but it was created by the Russians. I don't know if those were the same Russians that Trump was in bed with, figuratively and literally, in 2016, supposedly. But we were given the line that, okay, there's nothing to see here. This is a fabrication. It's all ridiculous. And a bunch of people who claim that they are senior intelligence officers all told us that we should believe that too. Okay, now we've come out the other side of that, and even the New York Times is admitting, okay, look, yeah, that's not true. The laptop is real. So the next line of defense here for the folks that this thing implicates in a whole bunch of activities is, okay, the laptop's real, but this is all about Hunter, right? Hunter's got a drug problem. Hunter runs around with hookers. He does all sorts of unsavory things, and he's probably broken laws and he's taken money, but it's all about Hunter. So not to minimize the various crimes that are on the laptop, because probably does implicate Hunter in all sorts of unsavory things that should be investigated. From the standpoint of the Republic, that's not the heart of what we're talking about here, right? This is yet another distraction. The point here is, you know, as somebody who's looked at the hard drive and retains a copy of the hard drive, my opinion as an intelligence officer and an attorney, what you're looking at is a guy, Hunter Biden, who is a bag man. Nobody hands Hunter hundreds of millions, billions of dollars because Hunter has amazing skills or is going to do anything for anybody remotely worth that money. He is the guy who picks up the cash. And then the big question is, where is it going? And the overwhelming evidence here suggests it's going to Dad, to Joe Biden, because Joe is actually the only asset Hunter has, right? That's the only reason anybody wants to talk to Hunter or give Hunter money, is to buy access and influence with Joe Biden. At the top of the list of unsavory characters, and it's a long list, that pump money into this enterprise over years and years and years, is the Chinese Communist Party. And at the heart of these contacts, documented overwhelmingly on this laptop, a number of individuals who are known Chinese intelligence officers. So what you have is every appearance that this is the Chinese elite capture system at work, buying influence, in this case with a guy who at the time, for most of this time period, was the vice president of the United States.
Sam, let me just do a calibration point on this, because you're saying this as a guy who used to suborn individuals, recruit them, and run them as agents for our government. You know something about the tradecraft of this business. You've, you know, done it as a career professional in the battle space, but you know, it was a matter of life and death that you did it well, competently, successfully. Yours, perhaps, certainly those of those agents. So, drawing on that experience, when you say Chinese communist intelligence operatives were migrating immense amount of money through the bagman to the big guy, talk about this as part of the tradecraft that the Chinese Communist Party would do. Elite capture puts a kind of happy face on this. This is a classic example, it would seem to me, of having an agent in place and presumably doing the bidding of the people who were paying him. Am I missing something here?
You have hit the nail on the head. I mean, the terminology we would have used in the agency if we were talking about some this kind of thing would be agent of influence. We didn't use the term elite capture, but the concept of having an agent of influence, a person that you, in our terms, recruit, it's what the language we would have used, for the purpose not so much of providing classified information, although obviously that there'd be a windfall of that as well, but for affecting the policies, decisions, and actions of a target nation. It is something that is done by intelligence services all over the world. It has been done since the beginning of espionage, which I guess is probably the beginning of time.
Some say it might actually be the oldest profession, but there's another contender for that.
There's another contender. I don't know. They might be linked there somehow. They might have.
Quite possibly.
Might be a connection. But the point is, yeah, I've been involved in these operations. I've conducted these operations. We've done effectively the same thing to other people, but we also are constantly in the field defending ourselves every day against this kind of thing by our adversaries. This is not a one-off thing. It didn't suddenly materialize. So when I'm talking about this, I'm saying, yeah, look, it is to me, in my professional opinion, very clear that everything you are seeing here ought to be setting off alarm bells, screaming sirens. Here's a man who at the time, when the most of the most serious stuff happens here, is the vice president, a heartbeat away from the Oval Office, but is now sitting in that Oval Office, who all indications are was bought and paid for by the communist Chinese, and there are others, but they got to be at the top of the list, years ago. Now, that has to be the biggest counterintelligence threat we have ever faced, a threat to the Republic. And we ought to be turning on all resources saying, we cannot live with this unresolved. We have to get to the bottom of this.
Hold that thought, Sam, because there are a couple of things that I want to come back to you on that flow from what you've just said and that underscore the urgency of getting to the bottom of this. We're going to continue this conversation with Sam Faddis about specifically something Joe Biden delivered of incalculable value to the Chinese Communist Party and what it means for all of us, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Senators have established that Ketanji Brown Jackson is unfit to serve on the Supreme Court. Will the majority of them now spare us the damage she would do there? Under cross-examination, Judge Jackson has signaled that she has not merely a problematic judicial philosophy, but a radical ideological agenda. Her mask has slipped, revealing an actual admirer of the Marxists' subversive divide-and-conquer strategy known as critical race theory, a slavish devotee of leftist identity politics, and a reflexive advocate for especially odious criminals, namely terrorists and child sex offenders. Some Republican senators previously voted to put her on an appellate court bench. They are now on notice that she would not only be a hard leftist justice, it is predictable that if confirmed, she will radicalize what is today a minority of the court, but possibly a future majority. This is Frank Gaffney.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. And again, our welcome to Sam Faddis, who is shedding light on both Hunter Biden's laptop, what we are learning about it, and I think we may learn considerably more shortly, but also what it tells us about what we must do in response to what we've learned. And Sam, I just wanted to set up that conversation with you by talking about a specific deliverable that I believe was a direct byproduct of either what Joe Biden had already garnered from the Chinese Communist Party or what was on offer if he simply was able to secure what came to be called a memorandum of understanding between the United States government and that of China, governing the access Chinese companies could have to our capital markets. And the way this came about back in May of 2013 was, as you know, the Chinese were given preferential access to our capital markets. Their companies didn't have to meet our standards, our statutory requirements, our regulatory requirements for accountability, for transparency, for governance. All those things that American companies have to meet to protect investors were over the side as a result of this memorandum of understanding. By some estimates, between $1 trillion and maybe $7 trillion has been, as a result of this memorandum of understanding, migrated from American investors' holdings here to those Chinese companies, some of whom, well, all of them work for the Chinese Communist Party, but some of whom work directly for the People's Liberation Army as well. So if you would, look at this as a case study, Sam, of something. If you were running Joe Biden as a Chinese communist counterpart to the role that you used to play, how big a deal would this be if your agent of influence actually performed that feat?
Well, I would probably get a significant cash award for that from my boss. Look, somebody somewhere in the Chinese intelligence apparatus has probably garnered all sorts of promotions and awards over this operation. This is what we're talking about here, Frank, and I think this is at the heart of everything we're discussing, is This is damage being done to us that is catastrophic. This is an existential threat. We're not talking about a guy leaking some secrets at some level that, yeah, it's going to damage our security, but eventually we'll catch this guy and patch the hole and shut down some ops and move on. You're talking about things that fundamentally alter the balance of power on the planet. Now, at the heart of that has to be the money you are talking about here. You're talking about lifeblood and fuel for our number one strategic adversary. I'll just use the word enemy on the planet. A nation dedicated to replacing us as the dominant power on the planet. And you don't have to guess at that because they say it all the time and they write it all the time and they discuss it all the time. You can't miss it if you've got ears, right? This is their goal. And you're going to pump just ungodly sums of money into these guys. Could there be anything more important from a strategic level to them? No, there could not. And you're absolutely right.
Well, let me respond to that question, Sam, because arguably that is in a class by itself in terms of compromise. But unfortunately now, in the period since Joe Biden became president of the United States and is engaged in what I think of as a wrecking operation across the board, domestic policies, foreign policies, all of which have, as we've discussed before, in common one thing. They all have benefited the Chinese Communist Party. They've been bad for us, yes, and bad for others involved to some extent, but all of them seem to have been to the benefit of the CCP. Which brings me back to the question that you sort of begged earlier. And that is, you said something to the effect that, you know, our counterintelligence operations should be all over this, ferreting out the extent of the damage and bringing, presumably, charges forward to prosecute those responsible. Is that being done, Sam? Is there any indication that our intelligence community is alive to this danger, let alone that the Justice Department is actually bringing, as part of what used to be called their China initiative, perhaps? Now wrapped up, another tell, prosecution of the President of the United States and his family?
There is zero indication. In fact, every indication is that absolutely nothing's being done. The FBI received a copy of Hunter's laptop way back when, right? In fact, they actually received the original laptop. It was a copy that was retained by the guy who was repairing the laptop that has since been cloned and multiplied. The original laptop was turned over to the FBI. I've been pretty close to this story from the beginning. I cannot document that the FBI even ever actually formally entered that into evidence or documented that they held it. But certainly everything we know doesn't suggest that the FBI has never done anything to investigate anything on that laptop. Okay, not the potential child pornography, drug use, SEC violation. There's a whole raft of criminal charges here that have nothing to do with what we're really talking about. And they certainly haven't come within 10 miles of doing anything to investigate the possibility that the guy now sitting in the Oval Office works for a hostile foreign power.
This is scandalous, as well as a grave national security peril, as you said. At End Magazine, you recently wrote that this requires a special prosecutor. You've had some experience with all of this, of course, out in Washington State as an assistant attorney general. You've, you know, obviously watched closely other special prosecutors. Most of us think that, you know, this is just a formula for endless investigations and witch hunts and so on. But in this case, how else are we going to get to the bottom of what's happened here and the extent of the damage associated with it?
I don't see another way that we are. Look, we cannot have this mountain of information sitting here. As I said, you ought to be hearing just nothing but alarm bells and sirens in the background and seeing red flashing lights. Good Lord, a threat to the Republic on a scale that really we've never experienced in our history, and just pretend like it doesn't exist. We have to get to the bottom of that. We have to empower somebody to dig into it and tell us what is going on. And particularly in light of, you talked about this example of the issue with finances and access to our capital markets and so forth. But there's an endless list of things just really in the last 14 months that Joe Biden has done that are doing catastrophic damage to our national security every day. We got Chinese troops on Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan training Haqqani network operatives, obviously not for actions in Afghanistan, for attacks abroad, all because of Joe, right? I mean, we could go down this list. We got Iranians who are have an alliance with China firing ballistic missiles at our consulate in Erbil in northern Iraq, and we're ignoring that. Ballistic missiles fired from Iranian territory on our diplomatic compound, we act like it doesn't happen. We could do this all day, right? This guy is destroying our national security by the moment. Yeah, we got to dig into this.
We've got to get it to the bottom of it. You're absolutely right. Sam Faddis, thank you for raising this alarm. Thank you for the clarity that you bring to it from your own life experience as well as your common sense. Thanks for all you do at AnnMagazine.com these days. I hope people will go there and come back to us again very soon if you would. Next up, we're going to talk with Colonel Grant Newsom. We're going to visit with him about China and what is coming next from Xi Jinping as he mulls an attack on Taiwan. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and a pleasure to say we are joined by Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a man who, in addition to his service in uniform, rendered it to our country as a foreign service officer. He's also been a very successful entrepreneur and businessman in Asia for quite some time, and denizen of several think tanks, one there in Japan and here in the United States, our Center for Security Policy. We're delighted to have him with us always. Colonel, thanks for joining us once again here at Securing America.
My pleasure. Glad to finally be here.
Okay. I've got an issue that I'm anxious to get your best professional judgment about, Colonel, and that is Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, clearly seeks to acquire Taiwan in one way or another. It's a little unclear at the moment whether that will be through the use of force or whether it will be through other means, coercive, presumably non-kinetic. Also unclear is the exact timing, but I'm very interested in your thoughts about whether his calculations on both the use of force and the imminence of this action has been affected by what he's seen happening with and to his strategic partner, Vladimir Putin, in Ukraine.
I think his calculations have definitely had to be revisited. He, like Putin, she was expecting a very short conquest of Ukraine, 3-4 days, and she was probably thinking about the same for Taiwan. So after what's happened in Ukraine, the Chinese are going back to the drawing boards. But the important thing to remember is it's not going to make them stop going after Taiwan. They're just as committed as ever. They're simply going to readjust. And the Chinese will say, okay, the Ukrainians put up a more of a fight than we expected. Well, then we're just going to hit the Taiwanese much harder. The Russians went easy. So we're going to really hammer them. We're going to close down the entire internet. We're going to really hit them with missiles and our Air Force and our Navy. The Russians didn't do that. They eased up. So the Chinese will do the calculations to just use a whole lot more force. Now, when will this happen? I don't know. I would have guessed sometime after 2023. But after she met President Biden, I have some real doubts now. And why I say that is if you listen to what the Chinese are saying, it's all the Americans are to blame for what happened in Ukraine, not the Russians. The Chinese are providing full support for the Russians. They're attacking the Americans for putting on sanctions against the Russians. There's something about the tone of the Chinese that really is unnerving. And it sounds like they may think that this is their chance to get Taiwan and also to upset the entire sort of Western order that we've seen since World War II. They may see this as their chance. So while I thought it might have been after 2023, it could come sooner than that. But I think you are going to see the Chinese really turn up the heat on Taiwan.
One of the considerations, presumably, for Xi is he's facing considerable internal opposition, apparently. He's looking towards the fall when he will have a party congress in which he expects to be coronated for a third term. And yet that resistance seems to be rising. And I'm wondering, Colonel, whether you might expect to see him engage in what tyrants often do, which is social engineering. Blame a foreign adversary, as you mentioned, us, for difficulties they're experiencing, justifying further repression at home and perhaps external aggression to get people rallying around the flag and the leader. If that is in fact going on, might we see this invasion, this crackdown, whatever you want to call it, on Taiwan taking place between now and the fall?
Possibly. You know, as I say, I wouldn't have thought so if you'd asked me a week ago, 2 weeks ago, but there's something that just gives me a bad feeling about this. As you note, it is the classic response of these kinds of regimes when they are facing domestic trouble or opposition to go after a foreign enemy, foreign adversary, and sort of rally people around the flag. It could be the case in China, but one aspect of this is Xi reckons that this is the thing that is going to make him famous in Chinese history forever if he takes Taiwan. And also, he spent a lot of time building up this military, getting it ready to go. And that's something else which sort of weighs in favor of rolling the dice the way he might look at it. But also remember, he made a speech before the Russian invasion where he said, you know, Mao going into Korea, it resulted in 100 blows on China and it caused all sorts of trouble, but it was the right thing to do for China. And that is something that anyone who follows this ought to take very seriously as to what is coming down the road.
Another factor, of course, as we've been talking about on this program a lot, is the consideration that he must have that his old friend, Joe Biden, is president of the United States. There's an increasing concern about the extent to which Joe Biden has been compromised by the Chinese Communist Party. It might also weigh on him that there's never going to be a better moment than having somebody who they have their hooks in running the United States if they are going to take action against Taiwan, where the United States might otherwise be considered likely to try to intervene. Your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I wish it wasn't the case, but I'm afraid that there's probably something to that. You look at this administration and look at it from, I say, Xi's perspective, seems confused, reactive, sort of ad hoc. And you do have to look at the connections, the relationships that too many of these people in the administration involved in foreign affairs have had with the People's Republic of China. And that is an unfortunate thing to say. So that is, I think, part of the equation. And also consider it as well from China's perspective. Now look at what has been done to Russia. There's been sanctions put on. They're actually supplying the Ukrainians somewhat. But it's nothing China can't handle. They just might say that. Now consider that even while the Americans are sort of at war with Russia and they've put on sanctions, that they are still allowing Russian oil to be sold. The Europeans are still buying Russian oil in the middle of this war. And also, more importantly, remember the Americans are begging the Russians to help them cut a deal with the Iranians. And this is kind of insane. I don't understand it at all. But China looks at it and thinks, well, the Russians attacked Ukraine and they are still allowed to do business with Europe. The Americans still want their help with Iran, and climate change, of course, and North Korea. So the Chinese may think, well, we go after Taiwan. And yeah, there'll be some complaining, there'll be some sanctions, but nothing we can't handle. And the Americans will still think, well, we've got to have business with China. And there's going to be plenty of people on the American side, you know, who have their snouts in the Chinese trough, who are going to push for that. So China just might say, you know, this isn't a bad time to make a move.
Right. This is the Tiananmen Square model, I guess, where it's business as usual almost immediately, if not actually continuously. Let me ask you about one other issue in your portfolio, Grant Newsom, that we haven't had a chance to catch up on since it happened a week ago or so. And that is an election that I suspect came out rather differently than the Chinese expected. Certainly, many of us did, that in Korea, South Korea, that is, the candidate favored by the Chinese, favored by the current ruling party, favored, I'm sure, by the North Koreans, out-and-out communists, as best I can tell, did not prevail. And instead, we have a fairly conservative, seemingly very pro-American and anti-North Korea president-elect there. Tell us how that came about. I know in the past you've looked closely at evidence of electoral fraud. Was there any, and was it too sweeping an outcome for the election to have been stolen?
Well, just going back to the start, yes, the conservative candidate won. And he's more what you would call somebody who is in favor of the U.S.-Korea-South Korea alliance. He sees that as what provides stability on the peninsula and has allowed South Korea to develop and prosper. He's also he's not in favor of North Korea like the opposition was. He sees North Korea as an enemy. He sees China as an adversary as well, rather than some country to be placated. So it was a very different choice in outlooks on foreign affairs, foreign policy. He won. It was a close election by a couple hundred thousand votes, which isn't much. But nonetheless, considering that just a few years ago, the foreign press was all writing how conservatives in South Korea were going to go extinct, that the future was entirely this leftist shift in Korean society. And that has clearly not been the case. So what the Americans have got is a breath. It's sort of got some breathing space to get the alliance back where it needs to be. I'd like to see the Americans also put some attention to helping South Korea's economy prosper. Because many people do vote on economics, not so much on foreign affairs. It is an issue in South Korea. But like most people, they're worried about jobs, salaries, and inflation, and that sort of thing. And that's where the Americans ought to help their friends. As for election fraud that you mentioned, back in 2020, in the National Assembly elections, I was skeptical that anything untoward had happened. But having looked into it, I'd say it's overwhelming likelihood that there was substantial fraud on behalf of the leftist candidates. This time around, there were some suspicious things that happened, and I haven't looked into those in detail, but I have heard from people that I would listen to that there were some problems, but for whatever reason, the other side was not able to produce a victory.
It came out right, as far as I can tell. Colonel Newsom, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for joining us today. Come back to us with updates on all of this, if you would, soon. Speaking of the military threats to our country, we're going to talk with a distinguished retired Lieutenant General of the United States Air Force, Rod Bishop, about the war on our military Joe Biden is waging. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is Lieutenant General Rod Bishop, United States Air Force retired, a man who has had a distinguished record of service in uniform over many years, including senior command positions in Europe and elsewhere. He is also the leader and driving force behind a remarkable pickup team of senior military officers, now also retired, called Stand Together Against Racism and Radicalism in the Services. Of course, it has an acronym that's being associated with the military. STARS is its acronym. General Bishop, it's good to have you back, sir. Welcome once again to Securing America.
Thanks so much, Frank. It's good to be on, as always.
Thank you. Let me ask you, if I could, about some of that racism and radicalism that we're seeing. I kind of describe it as a war against the military that the Biden administration has been waging. And maybe we could start with this whole idea that there's systemic racism in the services, and it has to be rooted out through critical race theory indoctrination. What are you seeing in the service academies, but also in the military more broadly in this regard?
Unfortunately, our evidence is anecdotal, but it's over 600 anecdotes. So I think when you pile them together, that tells quite a story. We were founded really just upon a football video. We'd like to think that the Air Force Academy football coaches put out. We know we had a part in educating the academy on Black Lives Matter and the Marxist roots, and they eventually took the video down. But the tentacles of this Marxist thought are much, much deeper than just that one video.
Yeah. Well, and not just in the military, of course, either. But of particular concern, as Don Rumsfeld used to say, you go to war with the military you've got. If we're doing violence to it, and I think of this as at least intellectual violence, it's a problem. It's not confined to that, though. We're also seeing the cumulative effects of years now of a kind of social engineering of the military. We've got, of course, in addition to the racism, a lot of sexual mores and transgender initiatives and indoctrination. And along with it, to some extent at least, lowering of standards. Is that of concern to you as a former commander, looking at what is the cumulative effect of all this on the military?
Absolutely. Frank, I worked in admissions at the Air Force Academy back in the early 80s, just 15 years after the civil rights laws were written. And we convinced ourselves back then that, look, kind of like Shelby Steele tells us today, that, you, America, gave us our freedom, not really until the 1960s. And so we were only 15 years or so after that. So I can tell you that we bent the rules or the standards to bring the academy to reflect the rest of America. And I didn't feel bad about it then. But here we are two generations later. And I think our nation is ignoring, by continuing to bend the standards and lower the standards, the real root causes. I mean, we have a very good ally in Take Charge, a Minnesota, a black man, former Army officer that is running for governor there. And he, his big two things are, look, black America, we need to wake up. When I was growing up in the 60s, he said, we had two-parent families at a rate of 80%. Now we're down to 20%. And our inner city schools haven't gotten any better. Those are the root causes I think our nation should attack instead of just continuing to bend the rules and the standards. Because we're not going to fix this long term. And what it's doing now is it's creating resentment among the rest of society. So even if you got people, and I'll use the academy again as an example, into the service and into the academy, but now we see it being taken a step further. We see a majority or out of whack percentages of minorities and females in leadership roles, just because there happens to be a goal out there. And that's wrong. That's demeaning to those populations. And it's very discouraging to the white males who have told me on many occasions, you know, why bother?
Right. Why serve? Why sacrifice? Why put myself in harm's way for my country if this is how we're going to be treated? It's compounded, of course, General, as you know, by two other things. Purges of those deemed to be perhaps, I don't know, Trump voters or conservatives, you know, the sort of people that are deemed to be not with the program of the Biden administration and its so-called combating extremism program administered for the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, by a fellow by the name of Bishop Garrison, who seems to be all in with the agendas we've just been talking about. And also, I know you've been very concerned, and STARS has been quite engaged on this issue of compelling service personnel to take these vaccinations for COVID. Talk about the cumulative effect, if you would, sir, about all of these things on, well, as you said a moment ago, the willingness to serve in our military.
Well, let me start with the first one, Frank. You know, when the secretary said last February that we're going to have an extremist down day, I think most of your audience is probably aware that the examples of the extremist down day were all white supremacist examples from 2019. Nothing about Black Lives Matter and Antifa riots through the summer, of which many members of the service supported those. So it does seem like all of that time and effort that's put in, what are we, you know, couple of million in uniform, and they found 100 examples. I mean, it seems like a lot of effort, and the focus, well, it should be across the board, not just on quote white extremism.
Hold the thought on the vaccinations, if you would, sir. We've got to take just a very short break. We're visiting with Lieutenant General Rod Bishop, United States Air Force retired, an extraordinary commander and leader now in his retirement. Those now out of uniform, deeply concerned about what is happening to the services they've participated in the past and love and know are vital to the security of this country, particularly at a moment when, as we talk about on this program every day, we are facing a world of hurt. It's vital that we get this information out. General, come back. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and I'm pleased to say we are continuing this important conversation, very timely conversation, with Lieutenant General Rod Bishop, the former senior officer in the United States Air Force. General, you have started to warn us about, among other things, this idea that vaccine mandates can be imposed on the armed forces without impact on the men and women serving in uniform. explain why that's of concern.
Well, let me begin by saying, Frank, that I'm a former seven-time commander, and I was always out in front saying, look, we've got to get a shot, be it the flu shot or the anthrax before we went into Iraq, because it's the first element in force protection. But I'm also a common sense kind of guy. And in this particular case, there's a lot of things that just don't add up. So first and foremost, I would say that, you know, the basics of the Hippocratic Oath is to do no harm. And we need more explanation about that Department of Defense medical database. I'm sure you've seen Senator Johnson's hearing or panel on that. And so either the Defense Department lost complete control of the database for 4 or 5 years, as they now claim, or the sworn affidavits of three DOD lawyers, two of whom are lieutenant colonels, saying, look, we're seeing a lot of adverse effects from these shots way out of whack with the last 4 or 5 years worth of data. That needs to be explained, I think, before we start mandating that people put things in their bodies, because we know that there are a lot of harmful effects. Even the VAERS database, which is all volunteer, has more adverse reactions to the COVID vaccine than all other vaccines since 1990. So that's something's wrong there. Secondly, DOD has not recognized natural immunity. There's 150 positive studies that show natural immunity as the gold standard. I mean, I didn't get vaccinated against the mumps and the measles because I had them. So people have had COVID. Why do we want to spike their proteins even higher? So that's number two. Number three, you know, the disease has moved on. We've seen that the vaccine didn't have very good effect against Omicron. In fact, there's a growing body of evidence there that says if you had been vaccinated, it may have even increased your chances of getting Omicron. So, and then finally, number four, I mean, there's a number of federal rulings that have said, DOD, what you're doing is wrong. FDA-approved vaccine is Comirnaty. It doesn't exist in the United States. And so basically, you potentially are violating the Nuremberg Code here for experimentation.
Yeah. To say nothing of ignoring servicemen and women's right to waive out of this on the grounds of religious belief. All of these things are really concerning, General, especially when you put them together with the ones that we talked about earlier. And I know this is probably a question that's subjective and somewhat anecdotal too, but knowing as a commander how important unit cohesion is, the confidence of subordinates in their leaders, the degree to which the laws or orders, for that matter, are lawful. I mean, these are all considerations that would seem to be highly corrosive to good order and discipline, to unit cohesion, to readiness, and ultimately to deterrence of our adversaries. Would you agree?
Could not agree more. I think I probably said on your show previously that Clausewitz taught us that the moral factor is to the physical. In other words, that unit cohesion is to the, in today's day and age, the planes, the tanks, and the bullets, as three is to one. I mean, it's just so important. And all of these things, I believe, I've been told firsthand by members of the military, are striking a knife right into the heart of unit cohesiveness.
Yeah. Which is terrifying. Again, is it coming at a time when it's the only military we have and we darn well may need it big time in this dangerous world of ours? General, let me quickly turn to one particular theater of what I call the war for the free world, in which you have a lot of experience, having commanded in Europe, as I mentioned, Ukraine. Give us your thoughts on what's going on there. You, I gather, saw some of these problems coming a long time ago. And what should we be doing about it?
Well, I think a good part of that question, Frank, goes to what we should have done sooner. We struggled with this issue in 2006 when I was Air Commander Europe. And my first day in command, I asked the 1,300-person staff that I had, what are the top 10 things that should keep us awake at night? The number one thing they came back with was Russia invading Ukraine. There are two parts of follow-on questions. Okay, so if Russia invades Ukraine, we have three fighter wings here in Europe. What are we going to do with them? And is it worth putting our kids who are going to Ramstein High School and about to ready to graduate next year, their lives on the line to defend that? And the conclusions we came back with then are very similar to where we are today as a nation, I think. Although when you consider, I mean, what we envisioned, we didn't see us using those fighter wings except in a deterrence mode. But we saw a much more aggressive whole of nation deterrence taking place sooner. And we reasoned that we didn't have any politicians on the staff, but we reasoned that Ukraine was not a member of NATO when the former Soviet republics all did become a part of NATO in the late 1900s and the early 2000s, because primarily of Article 5 and the commitment that we would have to go to their defense. So if that's the case, then we need to deter and deter in the biggest way possible. So when you take into consideration on November 10th that our nation signed with Ukraine an article that basically says for full integration into European and Euro-Atlantic institutions, that's what we and the Ukrainians agreed to.
General, we have to pause at that point, sir, for the moment. We're going to come back to you, though, for a longer conversation about Ukraine and what's flowed from Russia's invasion of it. But for the moment, let me just say thank you for what you have done in the service of our country to date, both in uniform and now leading this terrific organization, STARS. I hope people will check out your website. Give it to us very quickly, if you would, sir.
STARS, STARRS.US. Yes, please come and join the fight.
Thank you very much for being with us for this edition of Securing America. Come back to us again tomorrow, and then go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.